Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Norman Swan, and you're listening to The Health Report. In this program, during election week, rather than doing an election special, I thought it'd be handier for you, and certainly less boring, to get some insight into what influences how you think and feel about your place in the world. You'll find out what political opinions men hold when you undermine their male identity. You'll find out what it takes to be competitive about altruism when you're giving things away. How hills literally look steeper when you're feeling down or isolated. And how attachment to our parents plays out when we become adults ourselves. It'll tell you a lot about some of our politicians. Let's start, though, with getting things off our chest and an effective way of doing that. It's called emotional disclosure. Associate Professor Kent Harbour is a social psychologist at Rutgers University in New Jersey.
Many of your listeners probably have had the experience of being mildly offended by someone in their world and starting to fire off the angry email, composing scud after scud. And then they pause to take a drink of water, they come back to their computer, and then suddenly they don't feel quite so infuriated anymore. Forgiveness is largely an emotional problem. Reasoning itself doesn't seem to do the trick. You need to deal with the emotions that underlie the feelings of outrage. Jamie Pennebaker, who is a social psychologist, has done an amazing line of research looking at the power of disclosure on physical health. He finds that when people just write their thoughts and feelings about whatever major event is going on in their life, they literally get sick less often.
So it's basically admitting to how you feel.
Admitting, but also developing it and expressing it. It's not simply purging or a matter of venting. It's actually taking dictation from your emotions to make sense of the event. And when people do that, they're able to get kind of a clarity and a perspective that helps them sort of move forward. But it's important that the disclosure needs to be both your thoughts and your feelings. Thoughts alone won't do it. And according to Pennebaker, feelings alone is the combination of a full disclosure, how I feel and how that's affecting my thoughts and my opinions.
Kent Harbour and his colleagues have tried to measure the extent to which getting emotion off our chests changes our attitudes to people. One of their experiments got participants to imagine three people. One who'd been good to them at some time, someone who was neutral to them, and someone who'd done the dirty on them. Then they were either allowed to disclose in writing their thoughts and feelings about the person, or some non-emotional facts about them.
If you had a chance to disclose your thoughts and feelings, it didn't change how you felt about a positive or a neutral person. But for that negative person, you made a movement towards feeling more close. You made the first step. And that first step is the crucial one towards launching a full-fledged forgiveness.
What utility does that have in real life?
It's a good question.
But sometimes forgiveness isn't appropriate.
That, I think, is a very key point. On the other hand, there are times where there's someone in your past with whom we have no opportunity to reach a rapprochement. At the same time, we contain within us the negative, hostile feelings that become a burden for us now.
So it's a grudge and you can barely remember what originally caused it.
Or you might remember it very well. The problem is a lot of your life gets anchored on something that is no longer of utility for you to persevere on. This process of disclosure is not going to change your attitude from this person from being a very, very bad person to them being a good person. But it might alleviate the amount of psychological energy and potency that it has in your day-to-day life so you can move forward. Benjamin Franklin used this technique strategically. He had lots of people who was very, very angry at, and they discovered they had sheets.
It didn't take much with Benjamin Franklin, that would have to be said.
Apparently not, but he knew this. He was a diplomat. He couldn't afford to always lash out to the degree he wanted to. So what he would do is he would write incredibly angry, virulent letters and never send them. It took care of the business.
The major focus of Kent Harbour's research, though, is the difference how we feel about ourselves and makes to our perceptions of very tangible things like pain, threats, and physical challenges like a hill.
What I'm interested in is what I call psychosocial resources, things like social support, feelings of self-worth.
And so that's things like the number of people you come in contact with each day. Can you call somebody when you're in trouble? How do you feel about yourself?
Yeah, so social support is, do you have people in your world who you can count on when you're experiencing a challenge or having a hard time? Self-worth or self-esteem is, do you feel like you yourself are a good, capable, able person? So what I'm interested in is, if you feel you've got sufficient resources, does that affect the way that you literally see these stressful things? Do they seem to be less large, less close, less loud, less intense?
Anybody listening to this would say, well, it's obvious, isn't it? You obviously are going to react more if you're isolated and feeling lousy about yourself.
One of the experiences we have in psychology is, yes, our grandmother told us this is all true. Our job is to actually show how accurate grandma was in ways that maybe would even surprise her. So what grandma might not expect is if a person feels they have good resources and they're standing at the base of a hill, they're going to see that hill is literally less steep.
Really?
Yes.
It's not just the psychological mountain that's less when you're feeling stressed and feeling the world's against you. It's the physical mountain.
Exactly. When we are feeling that we have more resources, the molehill will stay a molehill. It does not elevate into a mountain.
That's incredible, because you're used to people saying having cognitive behavioral therapy because, you know, I'm a lousy person, everything's hopeless, nothing works for me, but not something that's sitting there in three dimensions before you.
Exactly. And there might be a connection to that. One of the reasons that people who are feeling that they have fewer resources or feeling bad about themselves, that their life could be so difficult or stressful, is that they live in a world where subjectively hills are steeper, creepy things are closer, people appear to be more hostile than is actually the case. So you live more constantly in a threatening world.
So let's move up to the various studies that
Sure.
you've done. You've done one on social support and the perception of pain.
Yes, to what we call manipulate feelings of social support. We had people think about either the best person in their world. It's an imaging task, the psychosocial warm bath. You think about the person who makes you feel the best about yourself and how good they make you feel and how comfortable you feel around them. And you spend like 5 minutes immersing yourself in these kinds of thoughts and feelings. Or you think of a neutral person, someone you see every day you don't like or dislike. Or you think about someone who you used to like but who betrayed you. Betrayal is a particularly potent kind of negative event for people. The next thing they do is that they experience what's called the heat probe. It can vary from they feel nothing to they feel some moderate discomfort. What we found is that the overall ratings of these heat probes was rated most intense if you thought about being betrayed, least intense if you thought about a positive person in your life.
Does that bear any resemblance to real life, though?
What we did was very short-term. We had our participants think about someone for only a few minutes. You can imagine someone who chronically has someone in their life who's very good, or chronically someone who's very bad, could have potentially more profound effects.
That's pain, but what about these mountains out of molehills? Kent Harbour again.
There's a researcher at University of Virginia named Denny Prophet, who is a vision researcher, he's not a social psychologist. And his interest is how people perceive physical challenges, like how steep a hill is, especially if you're going to hike it. And what he finds is that the physical state or the physical burden of the person shapes and affects their perception of how steep that hill is.
The physical or psychological burden?
Well, his interest is in physical. So if a person is in very good shape, they see a hill as less steep than if they're in not so good shape. Older people see the hill as steeper than younger people. Someone wearing a heavy backpack sees the hill steeper than someone not wearing a heavy backpack. What our interest was, okay, if physical burdens affect how we see hills, what about psychological burdens or the alleviation of them? So what we did, we had our participants standing at the base, and we just got people who happened to be in the vicinity who are either all alone or with a friend, and they estimated how steep was the hill. They gave us a verbal estimate. How steep is it in degrees? They gave us what's called a visual estimate. They had a device that looks sort of like a pizza pan that you can open up or shut. And then there's a third estimate, which is called a haptic. When you put your hand at the angle you think the slope is, that sort of gets at what your body says, sees the hill. Prophet always finds that people's haptic measures, they're always accurate. Your foot knows where to place itself on the hill. But the visual estimates are those that tend to be exaggerated. What we found is that our subjects who were with a friend saw the hill as less steep than those who were not with a friend. And the longer they knew their friend, the less steep the hill became. In a second study, said, okay, there might be some kind of confound. You got people here show up with friends. People,
it could just be an accident of fate that they're turned up by themselves.
Or maybe socially isolated people.
Don't even go to the hill.
Exactly. So where the participants either thought about, as in the pain study, they thought about a very good person, a neutral person, or a negative person. They went to the hill. People who thought about a positive person saw the hill as less steep. The closer they felt towards the person they thought about, the less steep the hill became. Same hill, different social context.
You've also done stuff on baby crying. You really don't like your subjects, do you?
I love my subjects. I don't know how my subjects feel about me. Another question is, how does our psychosocial state, our resources, affect the way that we perceive another person's emotional or psychological experience? In this study, I had participants listen to a series of infant cries. And these are very disturbing infant cries. In fact, actually, these are infant cries that came from infants undergoing surgical circumcision without anesthesia. I got these recordings from a very, very sort of heroic researcher at Washington University who develop those studies in order to convey to MDs.
We spent a whole year going to Jewish circumcisions.
That's right, right. Call it sort of the BRIS research. We used these recordings in this study to see how would a person's feelings of either having good social support or bad social support affect the way they interpreted these baby cries. And they rated each one for how much upset was the baby conveying. And we found is that people with positive support overall heard these babies as conveying less distress than those with negative support.
It's not a very good thing, though, is it?
That's a really... I knew you were going to ask that question. So you wouldn't want a parent to be hyper...
galloping to every whimper.
Exactly. There's a wonderful line of research by Daniel Stern, was called Affect Attunement. And he says a lot of how we understand ourselves personally as our own sort of psychological selves is by these very early experiences with caregivers. How attentive are they appropriately to our own emotions? If we are sort of conveying at our infant state, hey, I'm a little bit upset, and our parents say, you seem to be a little bit upset, that's telling us that our emotions are coherently interpretable. If, on the other hand, a little bit of upset is responded with, oh my God, the baby's hysterically upset, then we lack confidence that we can convey to others our own inner states. An emotion is, in a sense, a persuasive message from you to you. Who are you going to be persuaded by in the real world? You're persuaded by, according to classic research in social psychology, we are persuaded by people who we see as attractive, intelligent, having moral rectitude, capable. Well, those are the exact same qualities that make up self-esteem. So if the emotion is a message from me to me, I'm going to say, okay, I'm feeling a certain way about this event. Should I go with that message? Well, who's the messenger? It's me. If I feel good about myself.
Do I trust me?
Do I trust me? Am I a good, credible source for being persuaded or not? So, once again, the baby cries come in for use. By the way, all these babies are probably now in their early 20s, but in any case, they've advanced science here. And so what we did is we had our participants listen to those baby cries. We had them indicate how upset they were listening to the cries, and then we related how upset was this participant hearing the cries to how extreme they rated the cries. And overall, there's a positive relationship. The more upset a person is hearing it, the more extreme they say the baby is in terms of the baby's upset. It turns out, though, that for people with high self-esteem, that relation is very strong. That if they feel very upset, they say that baby's really upset. If they say they're not upset at all, they say that baby's not upset at all. For people with very low self-esteem, there's almost no relationship.
They're all over the place. They don't trust their own views.
Apparently. It's not that they're any less upset, but the relationship between how upset they feel and how they hear the cries, there's almost no relationship at all. So it doesn't appear that those people are being informed by their own feelings in making this judgment. What it seems to be saying is how we feel about our emotions is affected by how we feel about ourselves.
And can affect how you make decisions in life, presumably.
Absolutely. If you know someone who's been very depressed, you'll notice that they have a very hard time making the simplest decisions.
Let's go down and have a look at your threatening objects.
Let's do that.
So we're now down at your behavioral dynamics laboratory.
Yes, we are here in the basement. In this study, we're interested in how a person's resources, in this case their feelings of self-worth, affect their judgment of distance between themselves and a potentially threatening object. On this long table, we have a model train track. And on it, there is a plastic train car, totally transparent, and it's attached to a fishing line, and this participant sits at the one end of this contraption.
So it's like an ophthalmologist's chin guard.
Exactly. And so here Doug is actually demonstrating. And using a fishing reel, they would use it to move the train car towards, there's a series of, along the track, a series of flags. They would stop the car at each of these flags, and then Doug would make a judgment estimate of how many inches the car was from his face.
What we haven't said yet is what is inside the car.
We haven't said that yet, because sometimes this car has a fuzzy cat toy, which participants are not going to be upset with. The other half of the time it has Vunt, who is a live tarantula. And some of our participants find an actual live tarantula a little bit unnerving. But there's another element to this. Before our participants make any of these judgment tasks, they go through an imaging task where they either think about their own most laudable personal success, something they feel particularly proud of that they've done, or they think about something they feel neither good nor bad about. They think about doing laundry, or they think about their own personal failure, something that they most internally cringe as they think about it. And they do that elaborately. What we find is that thinking about your own personal success, doing laundry, or a failure, doesn't affect your distance estimates for the cat toy. It does for the tarantula. If you think about your failure, you see the tarantula as 9 inches closer to you than it actually is. Feeling good about yourself is moderating how you're literally seeing a potential threat in the world. And what this can mean cumulatively is for people who have either low self-worth, lack social resources, they live in a world in which creepy things loom closer. Hills are steeper. Those people in the bar are looking more ominous. Babies are crying louder. And so if that's your subjective experience day to day, day in, day out, your stress level probably is going to be increased.
And what about the interplay with personality? People who've got antisocial traits often perceive threats where they aren't there.
That's an excellent question. And one of the things that we will be looking at, I would conceptually expect that what you're suggesting would be the case.
So it could make it even worse.
Yes.
Kent Harbour is Associate Professor in Social Psychology at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Still to come, what happens when you undermine a bloke's male identity? As if you didn't know already. But before that, I want to stay at Rutgers and go back to that theme of how childhood and infancy is a time when we're trained into our way of being in the world. Associate Professor Harold Siegel's special interest is what at times has been a controversial area. It's called attachment. He's looked at the influence how you attach to your parents in early childhood has on you as an adult.
Attachment in children depends upon how parents have raised their children, and mothers who are responsive and sensitive to their children's needs, the kind of mother we'd all would like to have, those are secure mothers who presumably will raise secure children. All other styles are insecure of one or another type. There are mothers or fathers who are more hostile to their children, use sarcastic language, don't like things when a child gets upset, don't pick the child up, don't cuddle them, try to distract them. Sometimes, like, you know, what are you crying about? I'll give you something to cry about. Those are the avoidant parents or dismissive parents. They avoid relationships. They dismiss the value of interpersonal relationships. And children grow up to be little avoidants who are self-sufficient, don't engage in relationships, somewhat become bullies of other children. They learn not to bully the secure children. They bully other insecure children. And the third major type are the ambivalent children whose parents are inconsistently responsive and sensitive. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. So the child never knows if it gets upset whether mom's going to be there for them or not. And so their answer to the world is, I have to cling to mom's leg all the time to make sure she's going to be here for me.
And the fourth style?
The fourth style is something called a disorganized pattern, which is a more psychopathological pattern, usually born to mothers who have unresolved loss, who have serious mental disorders, and these kids really are disorganized, disoriented. They might run to mother when they haven't seen her for a while. When they get there, turn away from her. And these kids probably grow up with some degree of issues leading them to some other pathology.
And it's been controversial, partly because it sounds like a sweeping generalization when nobody's a perfect mother or father. What's your position in terms of the evidence on exposure to childcare? Because if you believe it's strong, then that could perturb the adult results. And I mean, there's been, you know, almost like shots at 50 paces over this one.
It depends on what the parents do with the child when they do have them. I'd be perfectly happy sending my own child to 6 or 8 hours of childcare that I was certain was a reasonable place. And I made sure that I was a good parent, a secure parent, when that child came back. And I wouldn't have any qualms about that.
So the parenting you still believe is the dominant force?
Absolutely.
Tell me about this line, no matter how zigzag it might be, to adulthood.
The evidence suggests that about two-thirds, give or take, of the people who would be classified in childhood as one or another attachment style will keep most of that style into adulthood. Another third will change, either as a result of good things happening to them, bad things happening to them, family issues, it could be economic issues, divorce, divorce of parents, mental illness in the family, a variety of things like that, and they can change. And it can change either way. Therapy, for example, hopefully turns more insecure people into secure than the other way around.
You are an optimist.
And actually, we do have some evidence for that.
You've described the behavior as children. Describe the behavior as adults in those four categories.
Let's just get rid of the disorganized and disoriented, because they probably are experiencing, if things have not changed along the way, they may easily be experiencing some significant psychopathology. The secure adults are, unfortunately, I think, few and far between. But these are the individuals who have a pretty healthy outlook on life, who think the world is not a bad place, who know when they need help from others and ask for it, who are able to be empathetic to others.
You're just describing resilience here.
Yeah, resilience, I think, is a big part of it. Everybody knows the avoidance, probably more common in some people's fathers than mothers. It's the guy who doesn't change. He's not emotional. He's stoic. People call him even tempered, but just on the surface. These are individuals who would rather work late at the office than come home to the families. And the ambivalent person are the preoccupied people. These are the people who are calling their boyfriends and girlfriends on the cell phones many times a day. How you doing?
Feeling insecure.
They doing it out of insecurity, but they're convincing their boyfriends and girlfriends that they care about them. And it's amazing how many college students take that as a sign of love from their boyfriends and girlfriends, when really it's the insecurity in their boyfriends and girlfriends that's causing the phone calls. And so these are individuals who must be in a relationship, can't be alone, really troublesome.
So tell me about some of the work you've been doing.
So we're interested in these attachment styles, the secures and the avoidance and the ambivalence. And we've done some work on mothers and their babies, and we've done some work largely on college students. We know that when we ask college students to talk about illness, psychosomatic illnesses, for example, it's the ambivalent college students who express much greater symptomatology.
Things like headaches, tummy aches, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we give them a list of 50 symptoms. By far and away, it's the ambivalent college students who report the greatest number of these symptoms and the greatest severity of these symptoms.
And these are the ones who didn't know what their parents were going to do when they approached them.
Inconsistent parents, right? Inconsistent parenting, right? One way to get attention from a parent who is inconsistently there is to be ill, and the parent may have to be there more often.
What else have you found out about college students?
We're doing a study now on college students and their attachment styles reading court cases, actual court case transcripts, because a lot of court cases really are attachment cases. All custody cases are attachment cases. All spousal murder, spousal abuse are custody cases. And the nice thing about court cases is that we have nice controls, which are check fraud or things like that, which are presumably non-attachment related. And so we bring people in, we ask them about their attachment styles, we have them read real court cases, and then they talk about guilt and innocence, and they decide on some degree of punishment. And again, it's these ambivalent people who are so preoccupied with having relationships, can't live without them, and if they see a relationship being disturbed, they are the most punitive of all. So,
to the party who's perpetrated the destruction.
That's right.
What's the message, if you take the broad spectrum of your research, in terms of our being in the world?
I think parents really owe it to their children to try to raise secure children as best they possibly can. And a secure parent is not a perfect parent. I think you have to give the child a sense that you're going to be there for them. And children are forgiving and they're resilient.
But the other thing that interplays here is a child's temperament. And parents will respond to children differently according to their temperament and indeed what later would be defined as their personality. A study in Victorian Australia has shown that temperament is incredibly sticky. It lasts. You know, the crying, difficult child becomes the difficult toddler, becomes the difficult adolescent. And surely that affects attachment.
There's no doubt about it. But I give greater weight to the attachment issue than the temperament issue. And a securely attached parent can do pretty good things, wondrous things, with a difficult temperamental child.
And they're testing ways of changing young adults into more secure styles before they become parents. And of course, some Australian researchers are doing the same thing. Associate Professor Harold Siegel's in the psychology department at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. One of the features of this election campaign is how willing both sides have been to give away your money and mine as if it's their own. And the reasons are far from altruistic. Luckily, though, there are plenty of people who give away their money for the best of reasons. But altruism is far from straightforward, and what Rob Willer's been studying is something called competitive altruism, which no doubt charities love. But the competition may be for someone's charms. Rob Willer is Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley.
What we thought we'd observed is that people will compete to behave more altruistically than one another if there's some opportunity for a potentially profitable social interaction. We thought we observed this in mating type dynamics amongst humans, but also just in everyday gift giving.
The black tie dinner and that sort of thing, where you have the business contacts and you give on the side.
Exactly. Corporate philanthropy is a great example of that. Or that rush to pay the bill at a group dinner, which seems counterintuitive from an economic perspective.
So how did you study this?
We set up a study where people could behave altruistically towards someone else, and we set up different conditions. In one, no one was watching what they were doing. In another, someone was watching what they were doing that would interact with them later. And then in a third, someone was watching what they were doing who could choose to interact with them or not. And it was in that condition that people behaved the most generously. Presenting this third-party observer who could choose who they wanted to interact with increased generosity and made it also competitive, where people were trying to give more than one another.
You were sort of currying favor with this third party, in a sense.
That's exactly right. And in the real world, that might correspond to anonymous giving situations towards charity versus giving and getting onto a public list versus giving when you have some instrumental partnership you'd like to instigate through the giving.
So was there much difference between the private giving and just the giving where people would know what you'd given but there was nothing in return?
Absolutely. Just as big a difference there as in the other difference.
So how does that translate to the real world, do you think?
You can see it clearly as when people compete to behave as generously as possible in order to solicit attention from a potential mate, be it male or female.
What about the situation where it's not money you're giving, but it's being nice to somebody? You see somebody in trouble and you spend time with them or you do a bit of work for them, which is often what makes the world go around rather than philanthropy.
Absolutely. That is every bit as much altruism as giving somebody money is.
Any evidence of competition in that kind of altruism?
I'm not aware of any existing research that shows competitive altruism with non-monetary resources.
What about the sense of obligation if you are on the receiving end of an altruistic act? Have you looked at obligation?
Yeah, there's an incredibly strong tendency towards reciprocity. When somebody gives you a gift, it's believed that maybe not only social and cultural factors, but maybe also biological factors drive you to want to reciprocate that gift.
In other words, it knits social organization.
Yeah, maybe part of the fundamental social fabric. Yeah.
You've researched this.
Yeah, some recent research I've done on paying it forward, on people's tendency to pay forward favors they receive from strangers to new strangers in turn.
Or in other words, somebody's been nice to me, I'll be nice to somebody else, not necessarily back to the person who's given it to me.
That's exactly right. When you get a favor from a stranger and then you interact with a new stranger in turn, I've found in my research you tend to behave more generously with them than you otherwise would have been. The basic drive towards direct reciprocity is so strong that when you receive a gift from a stranger, you want to pay it back. And if you can't directly, you'll pay it back to the next person you interact with.
It's the philanthropic virus.
You got it, yeah.
Tell me about the research you did, which got some publicity a little while ago on male identity. It's a fascinating study.
I was interested in masculine overcompensation, that when men are insecure about their masculinity, they fix that by demonstrating their masculinity to the extreme. I gave men a gender identity survey and then gave them feedback suggesting they were either masculine or feminine.
Irrespective of the results.
Exactly. It had nothing to do with how they had actually scored on the gender identity survey. And what I found was that men who'd been told they were feminine supported the war in Iraq more, had more negative attitudes towards homosexuals, and even showed greater interest in purchasing an SUV or a 4x4.
And the men who were told they were masculine?
They were not as impressed by the war in Iraq. They didn't have as negative attitudes towards gays, and they had baseline levels of interest in SUV.
So the suspicion about homophobes might all be right.
It might, you know, and this is not the only research to suggest that homophobia may come in part from masculine insecurity.
Where does that research take you?
I'm working on a lot of extensions on that research now. One thing I'm doing is redoing the study and taking testosterone samples to see if there may be a physiological marker for the process.
So you could take a pill against the war against Iraq.
Yeah, we're going to soon be developing a series of medications that can modify your political views.
Have you done it with women?
I have. I also studied women, and I found that women were not nearly as sensitive to feedback about their gender identities as men. One reason is that there's a variety of ways to be a woman in our society and involves a mixture of traditionally feminine and masculine traits. Have a job, but also be a mother. So women are used to negotiating complex feedback about their identity.
Rob Willer, who's Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. What I didn't ask him is how come then all these women drive four-wheel drives? You've been listening to The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan, and I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.